Zebra Stripes Podcast Season 2. I am Coach Gene Clemens, joined as always by Coach Whit LaJour. 2-0 coming off of the weekend. Coach Whit, how are you?
Good. Definitely 2-0 coming off the weekend, but like we tell our guys, 0-0 in my heart, you know? So.
I understand. You got to give them that. Give them the coach speak. Keep them grounded. Full disclosure, ladies and gentlemen, I've cracked open a nice bottle of tequila, and I have that in hand as we speak, because I have to do something that I don't really want to do. I have to talk bad about North Carolina.
In my experience, you know, it hasn't stopped you, but this could make you even go a little bit further. But you're drinking tequila. I'm sipping on hot tea. So maybe between us there is a good middle ground.
See, I thought you were probably drinking coffee. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking coffee.
I try not to drink coffee after the morning. Obviously, later in the day, like as I got older, not good for me. Will definitely interrupt sleep patterns. So,
gotcha.
No coffee. Yeah.
No coffee. How long have you been abstaining from coffee in the
evening afternoon? Hours? Which is,
yeah,
or afternoon. Yeah, I would say 10 years or so. I mean, I used to be coffee with dinner, or never would be a problem. And just, you know, seemingly out of nowhere, at one point I'd be staring at the ceiling saying, "What's going on?" And I traced it back. It might be psychological. I don't know. Tea doesn't seem to have the same impact, but I'm not checking my caffeine levels all the time with the tea I'm drinking. So
that's true. And there's a good chance that a lot of it might be just habit, right? Drinking of the coffee signals something in the brain or whatever that, is coffee. That means I'm supposed to.
Definitely. Yeah. It did feel like it. So then I started drinking, not a lot, but like if you're out at a restaurant or something, I'd order decaf, but that felt like drinking non-alcoholic beer. Like what exactly am I doing? And I'm not afraid of that anymore either, which is really.
Wait a minute. You drink non-alcoholic beer?
I will just say that I've on occasion sipped non-alcoholic beer when it seemed to make sense for me to do that.
What's your non-alcoholic beer of choice?
Well, if I remember right, I'll say that I think Heineken is not a bad non-alcoholic beer, although some people would say the regular beer is skunky or something like that. There was one or two that I tried that were fine. I think I've had the Buds or the, you know, Ultra. I'm not even sure, but there's, you know, I never thought I'd see that day either is my point, but I've seen that day. It's not a bad thing.
I have heard from people who have ventured into the non-alcoholic beer world that the Heineken Zero is the closest proximity to what Heineken tastes like. I think that's the rub, is because Heineken has always had that distinct taste, that distinct flavor to it. They were able to, you know, get that flavor without the alcohol. So yeah, it's interesting.
Let's be clear about this too, which I didn't know at the outset, but you know, non-alcoholic beer does actually have, I forget what, but a percentage very low of alcohol in it. So it's not zero.
Gotcha. My non-alcoholic beer is Mick Ultra.
There you go. I think most people would say the same thing. Yeah, I think most people would say the same. And I do that too. So Coors Light and Bud Light and something like that, and just, you know, one or two of those, and I'm perfect. I'm good.
So
I'll try that Mick Ultra. I have not had one.
I'll say this for me. It's very rare that I consume a large amount of beer regularly. Like, now there are times where, you know, right. you get me in the right place and right time with some right people, I can still hold my own. But on a normal occasion, if I have a beer, I'll probably have one or two and I'm good. Yep. You know, there's no real pressure or no real desire to like pound them back, you know?
Right.
Yep. And I can be content. But most of the time these days, give me a glass of, you know, a glass of tequila or a glass of a good, you know, scotch or a bourbon, I'm probably going to be good with that. Just one, and I'm nice, and I'm good for the evening. It's a nice way to wind down.
Well, I'm glad you're good for the evening tonight, and I'm sorry to all our Tar Heel fans that you'll pay for the loose.
Well, I'm not. I don't think I'm not gonna like hammer. Because I want to always remember that, especially in basketball and in every sport essentially except football, it's a marathon, right? Like one loss in football much more damning than one loss in basketball. Three losses in football, and especially three losses in a row, your season's probably going in the wrong direction. Three losses in basketball, you can recover. But boy, it doesn't look good. They started off as the number one team in the nation, which, by the way, we both thought might have been a little bit lofty. Like, maybe that was hyperbole to start the season. But they haven't looked good. Even when they were winning games, they didn't look good in wins. I never thought I would see a North Carolina team that had trouble scoring. That to me has been the most alarming part of all of this. I've never seen a North Carolina team struggle to score. I've seen North Carolina teams that didn't play a lick of defense. You know, I've seen North Carolina teams that were streaky. Like sometimes they would score, sometimes they would. I've never seen a team just consistently look like they were not going to be able to put up 70 points in the game. Like, not since I've been a Tar Heel fan, and that dates all the way back to Dean Smith. So that's been the most alarming thing for me, especially because Hubert Davis comes off that long lineage that dates back to Dean Smith.
Yeah, so my best explanation, obviously, is that it's more mental, psychological than anything else, and that in some odd way, the hangover from last year, perhaps some of the subtle pressures that exist when you know, they put the mantle on your head right at the outset, just kind of messing with them a little bit, right? And so if they can struggle now and reduce those expectations, then maybe they can start the fight back. So I would have to, you know, that's my psychological analysis from a distance is, okay, they didn't want, for whatever reason, that team chemistry didn't want that anointed pressure after losing in a tough way with a 15-point lead at half in the national championship, automatically billed as, okay, they'll come back and win it. So rather than going through a season full of pressure, right, you stumble and fall and get out of the, you know, get off people's radar, and then maybe start trying to be the hunter again rather than the hunted.
Absolutely. I think it seems to be a common theme around college basketball this year with some of the programs that we've seen normally have an identity, right? Like North Carolina is known as a team that beats you at pace, that can put a lot of points on the board. You know, normally they'll have a big guy that can get your buckets underneath, but it seems to be going around the league, around college, excuse me, teams that normally have identities that they lean on, not really living up to those to those norms. We talked about off right before we came on, we were talking about Florida State. And I had said I had never seen a Leonard Hamilton coach team not be good on defense. But North Carolina hasn't been great on offense, Florida State's been bad on defense as well. And that's weird to see. You had mentioned Cal not getting wins. We talked about the struggles at Louisville, Duke having issues, John Shire there trying to, you know, make his own way. And we have all of this while dealing with these other teams that have found a way to break through into the top tier. Like, Houston's going to be a big problem for people. Houston's going to be a huge problem.
They have been a problem. They have been a problem for people, and they will continue to be. I mean, I would say you're exactly right with that. And before we get on too far with that, I got to add, with my regional bias, talking about the shifting landscape, that Maine is suddenly winning and playing very competitive, which people haven't seen that forever. So Chris Markwood in year one is absolutely on a less grand scale, right? They're not in the national spotlight, but anyone that's a hoop fan, you know, more than casual, is loving what Markwood has seemingly instantly done with Maine.
Absolutely. And I would also say up there in the Northeast as well, it sure didn't take Frank Martin very long to get UMass popping again, huh? Right? Like, they've been out there doing good things. It just shows you that when you have a guy who's a quality coach, he might not have the frills and the bells and whistles. If you put him in a place and give him some stability, he can get.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And he absolutely is doing that, which I like Frank Martin. What I know him a little bit and know of him, so I like that story. The other one I was checking in on because of Konzo was Missouri, and Dennis Gates, who came from Cleveland State, as I think they're 9-0 or something, right? And so, yep. But so I checked their roster, to your point, going back a week. They've got about 5 Cleveland State guys came with them, at least 4 graduate guys.
So a bunch of 23-year-olds.
Yeah. So, I mean, the bottom line is you better, you know, well, one of the things you can do to help yourself out is navigate that transfer portal. And obviously, if too many of the wrong guys transfer on you, then that's going to put a pretty good sized dent in your program. But I think both those guys, Frank Martin at UMass and Dennis Gates at Missouri, have clearly done a good job with the transfer portal.
I want to ask a question, and I want to welcome in our guest before I ask it, because I want to bring him in. He is one of the few who have braved the elements up at Bridgeton Academy, and especially when he has the same hue as I feel a brotherhood. I feel an instant kinship with this gentleman. This is Coach Horn, real quick. What do you teach in the class, or are you working on the administrative side at Bridgeton Academy?
Well, not technically a teacher, but I'm kind of like a tutor, mentor, in an FAC office, just try to help guys prepare, just help them with work, any work that they have to do, motivate them throughout the day, plan the schedules for some guys that's struggling, plan the schedule, just, you know, try to help them do the different things that they didn't do in high school, you know, to help them prepare for them to get better grades.
Gotcha. So you're like an advisor. You're yes. Like advisement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I always put it on two things. It's like, there's teaching, then there's administration. You kind of toe the line in the middle.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, definitely.
You have to be the conduit between both worlds. I always appreciate that. Sorry, go ahead. What?
No, I was gonna say, Gene, but Paris isn't gonna tell you because he's humble anyway. He's too humble. But the bottom line, he's worn a few hats in his short time. So, I mean, he was part of the residential life team, student life. Then they, you know, brought him over to the academic side of things. And we're not even talking about the behind the scenes work, say, when he's been in a dorm. And you know, so we laugh around here because, like, if anyone wants anything done, they just go to Paris. Like, so if I wanted to get a raise, I just say, hey, Paris, could you go see the boss and tell him, you know, I need a raise? Or if we need to build a new building, like, yeah, go tell Paris to go talk to the trustees. So Paris gets things done. That's his MO around here. You ask anyone, that's probably the highest compliment you could pay him. Is he's not a talker. He's a doer.
Doer. Definitely a doer. Yeah.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Paris Horn. He's assistant basketball coach for Bridgeton Academy. But as you've heard from Witt, he does a lot more than that. Paris, I appreciate you joining us, coach.
Well, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I've got a couple questions that are not really sports related, but more Bridgeton, Maine related.
Okay.
I've been where you are.
Yeah.
Right. I was just talking to Witt about this before we came on. When I was there, I was one of two black men
mm-hmm.
on the campus. He right. informed me that you are, in fact, one of two on campus. Like how I tell us where did you come from, and is this something that you had to get used to? Or is it something that you've kind of been used to because of wherever life has led you from?
Well, I come from Philadelphia / Middletown, Delaware.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's where I went and grew up at. So, but coming back to Bridgeton, it's kind of been it didn't bother me. I look at myself as like a chameleon, being able to adapt to whatever my environment is. Always been a likable person, get along with people. Like Coach said, I can wear many different hats. That's just who I am. So it was kind of easy for me, but coming back up here and I didn't even look at it as like being the only black guy there. I just kind of look at it as helping out Bridgeton, helping out, you know, the community, helping out the guys, helping out, yeah, just the guys and their situation. And, you know, playing for Coach helped a lot too, knowing what the school needs and wants, knowing what Coach Witt wants. So me being able to come back and relay that message to the guys and just being an asset, just helping out where I can, I think it made the job easy for me. And yeah, it's been great since I've been back.
I know Coach Witt speaks highly of you, which I think for me says everything that I need to know. Coach Witt's not one to just, you know, blow smoke up glutes about
yep.
anybody if he's not really digging you. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're here. Are you married?
Not yet.
You have a fiance because you just said not yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Did you come in with this fiance?
Not fiance, girlfriend still. And yeah, but she's not up here. She's still back and forth in Maryland.
Okay.
She works from home. Her job didn't allow her at first to be up here. So we've been working on that, but she's, you know, she comes back and forth.
Absolutely. Cause I was going to ask if you were an importer, exporter. You know, when it came to the situation,
yeah.
these are things that, you know, if anybody has ever worked in prep schools,
mm-hmm.
I don't think this is actually exclusive to Bridgeton Academy, because I've worked in a few prep schools. You're either an importer or you're an exporter when it comes to that situation. Yeah. I was a constant export. I had to go. And some days that meant some really harrowing
mm-hmm.
rides down, you know, down really narrow roads with snow on them yep. to get to Portland.
Yep.
But I was willing to risk it.
Yeah, I mean, hour drive, you know, I mean, I'll still go out, you know, just to I could call it, I play around and say, like, keep your sanity, just because I'm a city kid. So,
absolutely.
You know, has what it has to offer, but sometimes you need the city just to go out, let your hair down. You work so hard, so you just go out and, you know, just have a good time a little bit and then come back, and it's only an hour down the road. So
it's only an hour.
Yeah, it's only
an hour. But I'll tell you, I was born in the North, but my adulthood, like, I had to reintroduce myself to the North when it came to how to do things like driving in snow and deal with the elements. I remember us on a bus, we're on the bus coming back from somewhere, and it's a full on blizzard.
Yep.
And the bus driver is acting like it's nothing. And we were on some buses, boy. I tell you, we were on some buses, and the bus driver is like, it's nothing. And I am white knuckled on the side of this thing. Like, oh my gosh, I just hope you don't like slide. Cause I've literally been driving and just slid right off the road. Like nothing happened. I didn't hit any brakes. It was just like, I was driving and zoop, like right off to the side. I looked around. Okay, I'm good. Can I get this out of this area? Mm-hmm. All right, I'm good. Okay, let's keep it moving.
Yeah.
But so it was different for me. I'm assuming you being from Philadelphia had a better understanding of how to navigate the elements.
Definitely. But it was still, you know, I had to adjust coming back because when we was here, we was taking the bus. We had our bus to take us to games. So when I got back, the school were driving vans. Whit was driving the vans, and so that's our new thing, you know, driving vans to the games, 4 hours, 5 hours there and back, and then you gotta adjust to the snow. And you know, usually you could drive yourself and it's easy, but now you got the guys in there, so you gotta watch. You gotta be mindful of how you drive and make sure everybody's good, and you know, just take precautions. So that was an adjustment for me, but you know, I got a pretty good handle on it.
A good assistant coach, I believe, is like water, right? You have the head coach, which is the structure, and then a good assistant coach fills in wherever is necessary. Yeah. I think that's one of the things that so many assistant coaches miss, right? When your job is to just fill in the gaps fluidly, because the gaps change.
Right.
Where do you feel like you fill in the most for Whit?
I would say getting his message across. You know, I would say that getting his message across. You know, I know how he want to play, or you know, just how he talk. Just from, you know, him coaching me and being able to be coachable through that, and then coming back, I would say getting his message across. So sometimes his delivery could be different from what guys are used to, especially now. Just the generation is a disconnect of how, you know, they think you're talking at them sometimes. So his delivery can be different. So I'll come in and I'll tell him, don't listen to the tone of the message. Listen to what he's saying with the words, you know. And then the guy's like, "What?" And then I'll piggyback and give him a story, like him chewing me out, going crazy on me, and then how you respond? Respond regular, you know. Like it's coach. That's what he does. If he stopped talking to me and not yelling at me, now I'm scared, because now he is like he don't care. So anytime a coach cut you off and don't want to talk to you and not, you know, trying to get the best out of you, you should be nervous. When they're coming at you, that's because they want to see you prevail. They want to see you reach your potential. And so I think just getting that message across to the guys is, for me, is the balance. That's how we do our thing here.
Absolutely. That's.
And I'll tell you what, Gene, I was waiting to hear his answer, which I think he's 100% right. But as a head coach, right, just looking at it the other way. And again, Paris had been off playing overseas for more than a decade. So obviously the last contact I had with was, you know, watching a couple Big East games maybe that I went to, but really back at BA. So The most important thing for me, which honestly, you don't really know since I'm not interviewing, you know, it's not like I interviewed, I just kind of took a flyer and said, hey, any chance you might want to do this? And, you know, he was in the middle of a rehab. So I said, well, you could rehab here as easy as you could anywhere else. But he doesn't fight me on how to teach the game, or he doesn't fight the, like, the vision. So we, there's enough of a similarity and agreement kind of on how to play the game, how to teach it, you know, and then communicating that to the guys that, you know, philosophically we're on the same page basically. And again, like he's saying, well, I would want people around me, you know, that can bring, put things across a different way, right? You always, you, that, that's best for an organization too. You want free exchange or people that have their own ideas, and but you got to be in alignment too. So I can, you know, that's probably the, I didn't necessarily know that at the beginning, but I've experienced both too. So when you have someone that to that level you can trust, and I don't mean trust like I got to worry about the guy killing me, I mean trust that your vision and his vision is you know, similar enough or identical, so that now you do, in fact, I think, increase your chances of being able to bring out the best in the guys, which obviously is the one thing that we want, you know, two of us want the most. We want to see our guys do the best.
Yeah, so. So I'm going to try to, because he said you were rehabbing at one point in time. You out here giving these kids buckets, right?
Of course.
Absolutely. See, Coach Witts, in his, you know, he's mellowed out some, but I'm all about giving these kids buckets.
Yes.
Like when it's just so when you look at the way that the game is played today, mm-hmm. what would you say is the biggest difference from the way the game is played today versus the way you played the game when you were at BA?
I would say, just, I guess that's worldwide, just the way everybody shoot the three. You know, coming up, we was taught inside out. Now it seemed like it's taught outside in, you know? I mean, yeah, like, I would just say like that. We played through our big man, you know, or my former teammate Justin Burrell, you know, yep. we played with, kind of played through him a little bit, and we just, you know, played off each other, you know, cut, curl, just that motion offense, good fluent offense, like to run, press defense. That's what I would say. I would just say it's more three shot a lot now at a higher clip than it did than growing up when I was playing.
It's interesting too, because I think that's one of the beautiful things about Brisson. They didn't have a dominant big man when I was at Brisson Academy. That wasn't the impetus for success in the years that I was there. For me, what I see the difference in throughout the landscape is the physicality.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't see people play as tough.
As
they played when I was coming through, and when even back when I was at Brisson and watching some of those kids come through, like, people don't play through contact anymore. Mm-hmm. They just, it's almost like a soccer style of
right.
of how they, which is why I believe Messi's, you know, so good, because he almost has that old school play through contact type mm-hmm. of game mm-hmm. that allows him to keep the ball on his foot. Even when he gets a little, you know, a nudge or someone comes in for a tackle, it's not just, oh my God, I just got killed.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the way in which these young men, and it's not a dig at their game, because I still love the game. It's not a dig at their game. It's just different. Like, I was watching the basketball team that was at the school that I work at play, and they're so athletic.
Right.
Like, yeah. They're so athletic. And there's times where I'm like, yo, you're up by 5. You should be up by 20. Mm-hmm. If you just like, if you just clamped down and got a little bit lower in your stance and started cutting off these dudes when they try to come with this little ridiculous, like,
the skill work,
it could be so much different. But the game has changed so much. Wit, you've been in the game through generations. Like, what have you seen as the metamorphosis of the game from where you were playing to what you see now and what you're coaching now?
Well, I'm going to, you know, that was another subtle dig because you said, you know, generations. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe 1.5, but that's okay. I digress for a second. So first of all, I think prior to the 3-point line, right? Because I was mid 80s. So that was right at the time I was getting out of college. So 3-point line right away. And other rule changes, which would be account for some levels of play. Like hand checking and all the different stuff there. There are, you know, the rules favor offense, just like football. So, you know, that it's not all on the kids. I would say that the culture, right? Most people acknowledge it's a softer, kinder culture they grow up in, and that translates over to the sports, which is why when you can find one of those dogs, you know, we like to call them repairs. So, you know, sometimes you'll still hear that expression. Those guys are worth their weight in gold because you don't need to bring out their toughness. They're coming to you with it. And then I, you know, the third thing that strikes me with just listening to you guys, and again, this is coach speak, but with today's guys, I find myself more, and it's a way of calming myself down too with them. But, you know, you're explaining the why behind everything you do, or more often you're just laying it out here. Here's why we're doing it. So you don't necessarily get into this tough drill you're doing or anything else you're doing and just do it because I told you, you know, because I'm the coach. You're explaining, you know, the reasons behind it, which is fine. I mean, I'm completely okay with that, but I think most coaches would agree they want to kind of know the why, and you know, so then you can have fun with that, because you know, we've had a couple teams here that we think are intelligent, and this group of guys has decent IQ, so you know, we'll turn that back around on them too and say, come on, smart guys, like you get this, you understand this, why you know. So a little bit of sarcasm there, but that beats just ripping their throats out with, you know, which I, again, like you said, I've gotten, you know, whatever you called me, I've gotten. But Paris gets on me about that sometimes too. He's, you know, I think he's selling to the guys. But when I was here, like, oh yeah, when I was here, we, you know, like, holy smoke, what did I come to practice with a machete? Like, what was I doing when you were here?
I mean, if we're being honest about it, with and here's the funny part about it is that Paris was there after I was there,
right?
Which means that he knows exactly the coach Whit that I'm talking about.
Yes,
like, you weren't carrying a machete, but you might as well have been carrying a machete.
Yep. Like,
so just a little something for people, for our listeners who want to know a little bit more about Coach Whit. If he stomps that foot at you, man, if he stomps that foot, you know, you did. There's something coming.
Or we call it foaming at the mouth when he get the target and his face red and his spit.
Yeah.
listen.
I can't tell you. Like, I'm a guy who loved being coached hard.
Yeah. Yes.
So yeah. Like that ish is right up my jam. Mm-hmm. I needed to know the why, but I could ask the why anytime.
Later,
I didn't need to ask the why in the moment. If you told me, hey, Gene, I need you to just go, and I need every time this dude comes, just put your forearm on him. That's all I need to know.
Yep.
I'll figure out the why later, because I was inquisitive. I was going to want to know, but that Whit style was right up my alley. I need you, like, tell me if I'm tricking off. Like, if I'm not giving what you need, tell me so that I can give you what you need so that you don't take me off the floor.
Yep.
Like my job, my whole entire existence of playing sports was to not come off the field,
mm-hmm.
not come off the field, not come off the court. I wanted to be in everything. So if you are, Whit was going to tell you what you weren't doing. He was going to tell you that. And I had a coach coming up who was trying to keep feelings. And I'm like, damn those feelings, dude. Like, just tell me what you need.
Yeah.
And I'll figure it out from there. Like, if I can't do it, I'm going to be honest with you and go, hey, man, I can't do it. That dude, when I was in high school, I had to guard Alvin Jones. Alvin Jones is 6'11", 240 pounds, went to Georgia Tech, broke all kind of records. I mean, I'm 6'4 on a good day. And yep. in high school, I was 175 pounds. What do you want? He was like, hey, you got to front him. I am fronting him. He's 6'11". Right? He's 6'11". And so I had to stop listening to the coach. My brother said, hey, bro, stop fronting him. Every time he get it, when he bring it down, go right across his head. Hey, listen. We gonna get it in the mud or we gonna get it in the blood.
That's it, yeah.
And so like that, like I always appreciated that watching Whit coach. It was always an intent to the fire. Mm-hmm. It mm-hmm. wasn't just like I feel like sometimes you see coaches that just yell for no reason.
Yeah.
Like they just yell just to be yelling, just because they want to be seen. Right. I never felt like anything that Whit did was a look at me thing.
No, yeah, always a message.
There was always a message behind it.
Yes.
So like, and I know we're cracking jokes on him, but we're also, you know, giving him his flowers.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is. But like, I feel like in today's society, we don't get enough of players that just want to be coached hard.
It's different. I mean, I feel like the generation is just different. I don't know if it's from social media. I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't want to throw shots, but they just I feel like they're just a little softer. I don't know what, like Coach said, maybe it's the culture or what. I don't know what it is, but, yeah, they just take – I don't, they get in their feelings like, yeah, you come at them the wrong way or you say the wrong thing, they take it to heart. They don't understand what – you know what the message is. You know, they just think you or if it's not going their way, and then you know you're talking to them, you're trying to tell them to do this, and the delivery is different than what they used to, they take offense to it. So
absolutely,
just trying to find those type of guys that can just receive the message it's been a blessing for us.
Or there are guys that have, you know, again, like you kind of hinted at, I mean, there are guys that you can just walk into the waters with. Maybe they, you know, so you're not going to reach every single guy, and not every guy is going to instantly like me or us or the way we do things. But I think by the time they're over here, and like you said, they understand it's not and again, I yell so much less than what people normally make of me because it's not the MO. But by the time they get to college, then the goal is that, the competitive guys are going to be ready for the environment they're in. Or let's take it beyond college. They're ready to get out there in a workforce. Because I heard it was Dave Smart, who's an unbelievable, legendary coach up in Canada. I've listened to a pod this weekend. And he was just saying it that, you know, on one hand, you do have culture that kind of frowns on too much competition and too much, you know, almost blood and guts, if you will. But yet you live in a day and age now when by the time you get out of college, man, you better be ready for the world because it's coming at you, you know. And if you're not ready to compete and get after it, you know, you're toast. So. I think that's still the value of sport is teaching healthy competition, which is the way I look at it. And unfortunately, that means maybe getting a little dirtier than some of these guys are used to. But most of them respond well over time. And
most of them get it and are grateful. And obviously that's why a transition year like the post-grad year, I think, is such a big benefit to so many guys.
Paris, do you think that I've long, you know what, I won't say it because I don't want to influence your answer, but do you think that an 18-year-old is ready to go to college? An 18-year-old boy, excuse me, an 18-year-old man, an 18-year-old boy, however you want to designate them, do you think they're ready to go to college?
I think it all depends on the character of the person, you know, the guy, you know, the boy, and upbringing. You know, if you have the right people, I feel like the right people in your life, or if you just have the right makeup, right understanding, mature about things, taking ownership, then definitely, yeah. But, you know, some guys don't have it. So, you know, coming to prep school, I think is a good route, a really good route to take, you know, because it prepare you. I looked at it as my freshman year coming here, you know, just getting stronger, being able to handle my work, being away from home, just everything, the brutal schedule, and then playing high competition each and every day, doing two-a-days. It just prepared me, not just for college, but it just prepared me for life, just facing a different challenge. And this one year, it prepared me for life to, after I finished St. John's, just going overseas and the same thing, being in the cold. I played in Germany my first year out. So now I'm in the cold again. I'm away from my family, just all of it. And first year, yeah, it really changed my life. I when I came here, I was nervous, but I knew why I came here. And I was like, okay, I'm coming here to get my grades together, get the scholarship, and everything else I endured here and learned here, I took it with me in life.
You said you played in Germany. With and just one second before you go on, you said you played in Germany.
Yes.
Is it everything that I've heard?
Depending, probably where you go. Yeah, nah, Germany was good. I played it all over, but Germany was really, really good.
I've heard great things about Germany.
Yeah.
From people who've gone to Germany and like, yo, they rot with us in Germany.
Yeah, it's really Americanized. It's really good. And, you know, you can – no, Germany is fun.
There we go. Say less, as we would say. Whit, what were you about to say?
Yeah. Well, I agree with everything Paris said earlier about the year, but I think even the way you framed the question is the way sometimes parents look at this thing. So it's like it's an either-or proposition. Are 18-year-olds ready for college? Of course they are in most cases, right? And then by extension, then the next question, say, for us is, well, then if he's ready, why go to prep school? And it's like, because it's not an either or proposition. The reality is what you're doing, as Paris elaborated so many ways anyway, is you're strengthening what any kid, regardless of his academic, personal, or athletic profile is, you're strengthening what that kid's going to bring to the table when he gets to college. Yeah. So it's not like, does he need it or not? Look, you can find a college, but what is that said kid, you know, going to do at Ivy League college, state college, small college? I don't care. It's, you know, like by taking a year, that kid is more ready, more prepared. He's going to outkick his own coverage, right? Mm-hmm. He's not going to be that ordinary freshman. And so that's, I think that's where we come in. Right? Can we arm these guys with skills across the board that allow them to do things that they beyond what they might have done without it? I mean, and I think if we're doing our job and putting the right experiences in front of them and the right challenge in front of them, then the answer is yes, regardless of profile. And I think, and by the way, and I say this because Paris used the word, as long as the kid has sound character, and that I believe too.
Like, forget, you know, an academic profile can vary, athletic profile can vary. It has to be a sound character. There's too many character flaws. Now it becomes really hard in the year that it really is less than a year.
Yeah, so for me, and this is why I wanted you guys to answer first, I am on the completely opposite side. I don't think that most 18-year-old males are mature enough for college. I believe it is 100% a maturity thing when it comes to college versus your female counterpart, which just matures faster. She goes into college with an idea. Even if she doesn't exactly know what she's going to do, she goes in with an idea. So many times we go into college, we had no idea what we're going to do. We're trying to figure it out on the fly. Or we get pushed into something that we don't want to do, but people have told us we should do. Like, there's a level of impression, I believe, that an 18-year-old young man has that the independent 18-year-old female does not have. And so that year, I try to put myself in the picture. When I left for college as an 18-year-old, maturity-wise, I had never been away from some type of structure, some type of, you know, and so there was an adjustment there. Now, my situation was different in the aspect that I had to overcome some just personal and life challenges that a lot of people have to overcome, but I didn't know how to interact with people that were not like me. I didn't have a good grasp of that. One of the also things that physical maturity from 18 to 19 is a real legitimate physical maturity. When I was 18 years old, I could dunk, but when I was 19, I was launching on people. Like, it was a different level of athleticism. And it wasn't even, I found dedication to the weight room or I started. No, just my physical body changed from 18 to 19, where I looked different. And in my subsequent years as a coach and seeing players at 18 versus players at 19, it just seems to be a thing where we just physically hit another level. Maybe not like
growth spurt
height,
right?
But with just the way in which our muscles are, you know what I'm saying, are developed and how we're able to take advantage of that. My body control was better at 19 than it was at 18. I just had better control of my body overall. It was a completely different me when I came home for my freshman year versus when I left for my freshman year. And I think that if more young men had that bridge between high school and college, you would see less guys fail and or fizzle out wherever it is that they ended up. If there was just that, hey, we need another, just one more, what do they call it? One more mango season. You just need one more year to let it ripen before you're ready to eat. Mm-hmm. I think that you would see so many more guys be successful. And I think that that's why when you see guys take a postgraduate year, they usually go right into wherever they're going and find some type of immediate role. There's usually not a whole lot of, I had to sit and wait my turn. You know, they find an immediate role somewhere doing something because they've matured beyond that guy that came out of high school. I think that's why we've seen the model of recruiting at the collegiate level change from, I'm going to bring in mostly all freshmen, So I'm going to bring in a healthy balance of freshmen and transfers because they're noticing that the maturity of those guys are going to be better suited for the game that they're playing today.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree with that. It just runs counter to the delayed gratification that so many people today is part of what, you know, we don't want to wait for things, right? We don't you know, delayed gratification. We want what we want now, and so taking another additional year so that you do this and that kind of runs counter to the idea. Well, why would I do that? I want to do whatever it is right now. What you made me think of on another note, though, since part of what you were talking about was athletically, I haven't been following this, so maybe it's already happening, but I don't think it's happening to the level I'm speculating. The growth of women's sport, you would think that some of these post-grad years and programs and academies that you've seen proliferate in men's sports in the past two decades, you would think on the women's side, from a sheer competitive standpoint, would prop up, you know, where women's basketball programs are trying to stash their best players in prep schools or this and that to, you know, again, to get a year of seasoning, you know. I'm not sure. Again, field hockey or women's soccer, I don't know what I there are some prep schools out there and good ones and bad ones, just like the guys, but there are people doing post-grad years for girls, but I wonder if in the you know, next decade there'll be more of it because we maybe, you know, we won't be saying, oh, the girls are so much more mature, because I don't totally buy that anyway. I hear it, and I think I don't completely buy it. I know they are at like 10 or 12 or puberty, like I think they are. I know that. A little bit of, yeah, casually, sure, the average 18, 7, but you know, there's plenty of girls making stupid decisions and doing stupid stuff. So I don't, you know, you got to be careful with that blanket statement.
I agree. It is a generality, but obviously, you know, we're speaking in general terms.
Yeah.
Although, like, I can tell you, as a guy who teaches seniors at a co-ed situations, yep, these girls versus these guys, yep, completely different. Yep. Completely, yep, different. But it does bring up the issue, because there may not have been an uptick in girls going to prep school. But there has always been a large amount of girls, especially in basketball, transferring. Mm. Like, it was weird because they started making note of it when the guys started doing it. But the girls have been doing it for a long time. Like, I'm here this year, my freshman year, and all of a sudden I'm at another school. You know, I've transferred into another school, and now this is a second. The girls have been doing that for a very long time. I read an article. I wish I could remember where I read it, but this was years ago, that talked about how many girls transfer. Women's basketball players transfer from one program to another. And it was a startling number that no one really talked about much until there was this whole, we got to do something about these guys transferring all over the place.
Yeah, and the reason people didn't talk about it too much, and I'll be honest here, I'm speaking way out of my knowledge level and probably beyond what I should be, but, you know, the elephant in the room back then was a sexuality issue in women's sport, and specifically basketball, too. So I think there were a lot of young women going to colleges and then trying to figure out the makeup of their team and whether they were on a straight team or a gay team and some of that. I'd be curious to talk to people in the know on this issue and whether we've made enough progress as a society that actually that is a more comfortable and open issue and not what it was, you know, so that I think I know for a fact, having worked at the university and this, that, and the other thing, I know that was a significant issue in sport and made a lot of people uncomfortable for a lot of reasons, right? And so now that we're a little more progressive, for lack of a better term, you know, is that still the same issue? I have no idea, because obviously it's not something that's not around it, so.
I'm going to get y'all out of this because I know we've all got things. Yeah. Paris, a little NBA. I'm a Lakers fan.
So am I.
Your guy Witt, I don't understand him, but you know what I'm saying? It is what it is. The Lakers have looked really good as of late, and Witt and I were talking about before we came on that it's the lint, and Witt made a really good observation that the linchpin is Anthony Davis. It's not LeBron. Yeah.
No, it's always been AD.
We were saying, well, it's interesting because all of a sudden now nobody's talking about Russell Westbrook.
Westbrook, yep.
Right? Russell Westbrook's still doing Russell Westbrook. He's still going out there and you know, but no one's talking about it. And then Witt, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Witt said, well, is it that he's playing better or is it that because AD is playing so well, no one gives a damn about what Russell Westbrook's
doing so well. They don't have, you know, AD's playing well now. So now it's nobody to put the blame on, you know, and we've been winning. You know, Russ was the scapegoat. I mean, we all knew how Russ played. He played the same way he played at Washington, where he was in Houston, when he was in OKC. I mean, his numbers been pretty much the same, except for probably his MVP year. But it's always been the same. That's Russ. He's going to give you 110%. You got to live with some of the turnovers. You guys live with some of the IQ decisions, whether it's a shot or a pass. That was just him. I think he settled down a little bit, and I think they just finally starting to get their chemistry. You know, AD was hurt a lot. Brown was out a few times last year. So now I think they finally just getting the chemistry together. AD is getting – he's healthy, and he's playing like he's healthy.
Yeah, I think the interesting part about – the Lakers and what they have going on is the scariest part for the West and really for the entire league is if this is the AD, then that makes LeBron a lot more dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that guy can be him for the entire season and can avoid the injury bug, which he's never done.
Right.
Which he's never done. If he can do that, and now LeBron can conserve energy to where you're getting like full throttle LeBron late in games, full throttle LeBron late in the season, full throttle LeBron in the playoffs. It's gonna be a tough out.
Scary.
For anybody.
And I'll give you one more reason, my final offering of the night here, one more reason to be hopeful if you're a Lakers fan, but you can only be so hopeful because it all ends in the West. And that is because in a script that has totally flipped, the West is now the East and the East is now the West. So the Lakers got an easier path to the championship or to the finals than they once did. And now the path for teams that are pretty good in the East is, you know, kind of what the West was several years ago. So I don't, you know, the Lakers got to get through Golden State, which ain't your normal Golden State. And Phoenix, you know, is you know, has chinks in their armor. So I don't think the West is this beast mode thing that it was for a while. And I think the strength is in the East. That's what I think. The strength is in the East.
This is for another pod.
Yeah.
This is for another pod, Paris. Will this man just said that the East was stronger than the West, and I totally disagree.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I only see three strong teams. Maybe four. You got Boston.
We're gonna have to pick this up on another pod, because if not, we'll end up having to do a part one and part two again. And I know you guys have study hall and all that good stuff like that. I appreciate you, Paris.
Thank you.
Much respect to what you're doing up there at Bridgeton Academy. Like I said, Witt speaks really highly of you. I don't know what your future endeavors are, what you have in your future, but the type of character that you exhibit, the type of man that you are, the type of influence you are on those young men, like I see you running your own program one day, for sure. Witt, as always, I didn't take any shots at you, even though you think I did. It's all good. I still love you. Good luck this coming weekend in New Jersey.
Yes, sir.
I know you got some good games coming in New Jersey. If you don't know anything about Bridgeton Academy, ladies and gentlemen, you need to find out some things about Bridgeton Academy. As Witt has said years ago, if you got to tell you too much, you're probably the wrong person for there. You know, you got to tell you too much, probably don't want you. Yeah. But he's willing to tell you some things. So if you've got a young man that's looking for an extra year football, basketball, great hockey program, and love what they've done with hockey, soccer, baseball, you know, is Coach Burgess still doing a little rugby with the guys as well?
I think he's still got a little bit. It's been a while, maybe.
The Black Knight.
Yeah, it's ready to come back. I think it's shut down for COVID.
But
it's about that time. Hey, listen, like I don't know if you guys are into rugby, but the rugby world is picking up in the United States, especially the sevens. Like the United States on the sevens is a different level than your normal rugby. United States will just get a bunch of fast dudes and out there just running by people. So for Coach Witt and Coach Horn, Paris Horn, I've been Coach Gene Clemens, Zebra Stripes Podcast. Make sure you like, make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. We're all over the place. Until next time, y'all be blessed.
I thought it was episode 7 because our last time was about 4 episodes anyway. So good night, all.
Good night.